Coming in 2026, the Feeding Matters International Pediatric Feeding Disorder Conference explores the theme, Feeding Development, where systems, skills, and stories connect. This entirely virtual conference includes over 30 hours of continuing education with keynote sessions from Emory Center for Ethics Professor John Leisiker and from the family nutritionist Alexandra Turnbull. Attend live, virtually, February 25th through the 27th. View on demand, March 9th through April 30th. Visit feedingmatters.org/conference to learn more. Register by December 31st and save $50 with early bird pricing.
Presented by Feeding Matters with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Feeding Does Matter. I'm Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters, and I am here solo today with two amazing thought leaders and practitioners and researchers to share about their research in feeding and what it means for the future of the field. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Pamela Dodrell and Dr. Memory Gosa. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, wonderful. So I think to get started, I'll just have you both share a little bit about yourselves, your background, and maybe how you kind of found the feeding field. So Pamela, let's start with you.
I'm a speech pathologist. I trained in Australia, which is where I grew up before moving over here 12 years ago. I guess I always knew I wanted to work in health. And I went to a careers fair at my local university and saw some amazing researchers in the area of speech pathology and dysphagia in particular. I did make a short journey into the adult population and then quickly realized I really wanted to focus on the other end of the life spectrum with little people. I had some great opportunities to get some education in that area through workshops that were available at the time, and then went on to do my PhD in this area because I really wanted to focus in on this area. And it was around that time, I'm going to say maybe 15 years ago, that I met Dr. Gosa at a conference when we both were first starting to publish our work, and we became quick friends and colleagues at that point and have collaborated a lot since then, both in attending ongoing professional development in this area, contributing to the literature base ourselves. And so it's been an ongoing journey. But I don't actually quite exactly remember how it started, but it's something I've enjoyed along the way.
Yeah. We'll get her thoughts on it too. Memory, how about you?
Hi, I'm also a speech pathologist, and I started on the pediatric end. I don't think I ever had a full-fledged intention to work in adults, but I trained at Ole Miss at the University of Mississippi, and it is near Memphis, Tennessee, and that's where we lived at the time. And so as I finished my graduate training, I started in early intervention. I was really interested in child language development, and at the time, there was a lot of very interesting research that was coming out in that area, and that's really where I thought I would spend my career. So in pursuit of that, my clinical fellowship was through Le Bonheur Early Intervention and Development, and I did EI work. What's unique about EI is that you are in people's homes. So we were doing natural environment and home-based services, and I would go into the home and meet the family. And my thoughts were we were going to work on language and speech. And most of the families that I worked with were not concerned that their children didn't talk yet. That was the back of their mind in terms of priorities. What they were really concerned about was the fact that they couldn't eat, or that they had a G-tube and they weren't eating by mouth, and that that was just a big limiting factor for their family and for their enjoyment of life together as a family. It put a lot of restrictions on where they could go and who could take care of their kids. And it was not something that was emphasized in our training at the time. So I finished my master's degree in 2002, and we had some dysphagia seminars. And as part of one of those seminars, we had one talk by Dr. Lisa Newman, who was at Le Bonheur Children's Hospital, and she was doing pediatric dysphagia work. And so we had had one lecture about pediatric dysphagia. Certainly had not done any of that as part of my clinical training until I was in the home with these families who that was their priority. And that's
Yeah,
it was a bit of a trial by fire because all of a sudden they were looking to me and to my colleagues for help and for guidance about how we get to this next goal. Their goal was their child to eat by mouth and to have cake on their first birthday and those kind of things. So that is how I started in that area. Learning, doing workshops like Dr. Dodrell talked about, reading everything I could about what we knew about feeding development and what we knew about pediatric dysphagia. Also had the resource there of the hospital. So working in a pediatric hospital, a lot of the acute need was around feeding and swallowing. So had colleagues that were working in that area that could provide good mentorship. And then through that and having my own children, went back to school to do PhD work to understand how to research and put out quality information that could help further the field. And I met Dr. Vogel at Dysphagia Research Society. We were two researchers from a field of about 500 at the conference that had a pediatric focus. So we, I think, luckily like each other and enjoy each other's company.
Yeah.
There were just two of us that were interested in the work. But it was great. Contemporary, we had good guidance from senior researchers and people who had really worked in this area, but had, it just really hadn't expanded the way it has now. We didn't have organizations like Feeding Matters and other groups that were really interested in advancing the field and increasing awareness of what it looks like for families that have children with feeding and swallowing difficulties. We didn't have the PFD diagnosis. We didn't things. So it has been a fulfilling journey from beginning to end. It's not over yet, but from the beginning to now to work in this area and benefit from the knowledge that came before us and contribute to that knowledge base now.
Well, yeah. And you make such a great point about being kind of the standalone leaders of research in this area, because it's so frequently we talk about. So in this podcast, we kind of try to touch on the research and really bring it down to be able to make it accessible to everybody and especially have lived experience contribute to it. And one of the things that we've shared with the podcast or just different community members before is how there's this discrepancy in the research of, you know, psychology has had their PhD for so long. And that's why you see a lot of emphasis in the literature for psychology. And so it's so great to have pioneers who are contributing to the research and pushing the research forward in a different domain, in a different discipline. And I think you two have been such leaders in that space for this issue in particular.
And I certainly do want to give credit to people who did come before us, like Dr. Jane Arbitson and Maureen Lefton-Greif. It's just, like I say, as Memory said, there's a small number of us that have grown, exponentially over the last 10 years, but it really was a handful of us the time we were starting. And certainly, like I say, some have done it a little bit longer than us, but we're all in it for the exciting future of where this is going.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And definitely like acknowledging what came before you all. And it's exciting to see like what's coming up from the student population too, of how many people are
right.
Interested in
it's exploding. In yeah.
Yeah. It really is inspiring. Now, Pamela, how did you get introduced to Feeding Matters? Because I think you were already at Feeding Matters when I joined, and that was 12 years ago or so.
Yeah, I had a great opportunity in 2008 that I got a travel scholarship, and I spent some time visiting major centers over here in the US who had already done some work in this area. And I think at that time, as we were saying, there really wasn't a lot. So you kind of had to go and seek out opportunities to hear from people who are already working in this area. And one of the stops I had along the journey is at Children's Hospital in Wisconsin, where obviously a lot of the core members who were involved with Feeding Matters from the very start were based. Colin Rudolph, Joan Arvidson, and Amy Delaney, also obviously a lot of the other GI group, Richard Noel was there at the time. And then obviously from psychology, there was Alan Silverman was there and his team. So it was fun meeting them. And they had obviously had personal experience with the founding members of Feeding Matters and were really eager to help from the start. So that's really how I first heard about it. And then I was obviously more than happy to join in any of the meetings that happened afterwards and learn from people and hear from families what the main issues for them was. So I think it was just an opportunistic meeting at one point, but it's one that I've really enjoyed and it's been really fulfilling to be part of that.
Wonderful. Thank you. I know it's been, it's just incredible what the, because it was previously Medical Professional Council, and then it kind of transitioned as we opened it up more to the PFD Alliance, and now we call it the Feeding Alliance to make sure we're more inclusive. But you all did such a great job of allowing the leadership of Feeding Matters at the time to really think about, like, what do we need to do to be a system change organization and change the field? And that's kind of the evolution of even how I got involved too, and learned with you a little bit more too, was the consensus paper on PFD.
Oh, and I really have enjoyed working with people with your strategic kind of thought pattern. Like, obviously, some of us have worked clinically in this area, but to step back and think, like, you have brought to the group about how we can actually make change in this area by partnering with key stakeholders. How do we actually affect change within, like, government funding and those sort of things? I think it's truly the partnership across health providers, families, and people with your kind of strategic business kind of background that really has helped move this forward more than anyone's been able to do before.
No, thank you. Yeah, it's like, so a key value of Feeding Matters is collaboration. And that's what I feel like is so important, is like everybody holds a different piece of the puzzle. And if we can all get together and share, and then like that's what moves us forward, and that forward momentum is important.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about some of the research that you all have been doing and leading. And I remember touching base with you as you were even just like thinking about where you wanted to start pursuing some of this research in particular. But before we get to, I think we'll start with your review. But before we get to your review, Pamela, one of the things that I've said on this podcast before is that you were such a voice in the consensus meeting around PFD when we were defining it, when the conceptual framework was being built. You really pushed everybody to think about using the ICF and thinking about function. And so I just, before we dive into the review, because I think it tells the story even further, can you just touch on for the audience, like what that ICF was and what your thinking was during that meeting when we were trying to think about how do we define this and have everybody speak the same language, even though we're all coming from different perspectives?
Yeah, I have to say that meeting was so much driven by the vision of Shannon Goldwater as a mother who had lived this condition with her triplets. And what I was hearing her say is that she really felt it was important for there to be a term that just didn't encompass the medical condition, but also how that medical condition impacts on the individuals and those around them, their family and the bigger group around them. And so having like an awareness of this WHO, so the World Health Organization's ICF model, so International Classification of Functioning, really helped put words to what I think she was describing. So the first thing she wanted was a diagnosis code. And that completely makes sense because once we have a unified term, we can track incidence and prevalence. And that there is a different WHO system that codes diseases, which is the ICD system. And that's where PFD sits at the moment in the R63 category. But then when we were trying to define what that condition looked like, we looked at this other WHO classification system, which used to consider three kind of arms: impairment, disability, and handicap. But more recently, they've framed it into more kind of functional terms. So impairment, activity, and participation. So it's recognizing that the same disease process can have a different impact on the person and the person, people around them, depending on largely environmental factors. The example we always think of is a child who has cerebral palsy who'd have a very different lived experience in school if it was all bumpy paths and stairs and no flat paths and ramps or access to special seating. And the same way we thought about for the child with PFD, they'd have a very different experience in daycare or school if they didn't have access to modified food or fluid, even like smaller or softer pieces of food that they could eat more efficiently, have less of a choking risk, or if they weren't included in the main mealtime environment of the school. So recognizing that some of that is related to the child's disability, but some of it's actually
what's imposed on them by the environment around them. So the very same child could have a very different quality of life depending on the supports that are made available to them or not. And certainly Shannon, in pushing for this diagnosis code, was never looking to stigmatize children. It was always about recognizing the amount of support they needed, and that the same child could thrive if given the supports they need, or really be struggling in terms of growth faltering or being at risk of dysphagia or aspiration if they didn't have access to the things they need, and recognizing how much of that often falls on their family to advocate for that and for a supportive system in their schools and otherwise. So really it was all just trying to look for information from the literature and guidance from this WHO ICF model that was really just trying to meet the need that Shannon had been looking for.
Yeah, thank you. And so even though that was kind of meeting the need of lived experience, what did it feel like on the professional side? And maybe that's to you, Pamela, or memory too, in thinking about function.
I think PFD really opened up a lot of avenues to provide services for children that didn't meet a strict definition of dysphagia. And to Pamela's point about tracking prevalence and instance of diagnoses, previously when we just had pediatric dysphagia to go by as a diagnosis code, we would get estimates of anywhere from 20 to 89%.
That's so true. The prevalence was like almost every kid.
All over the board, depending on how the individual authors defined it, you know, when they were doing their studies and tracking. So I think PFD, the diagnosis and the clear subdomains that are impacted really opened up a lot of opportunity to provide services to families that in the past we missed, because if they didn't meet a strict definition of a skill-based difficulty, and pediatric dysphagia was never meant to just be for those children that were aspirating, but very often, if they didn't have a severe form of pediatric dysphagia where they were aspirating and were at risk for growth faltering, or were in hospital with respiratory issue, they didn't qualify for services. It was very difficult to provide the services that they needed.
And Mambri, you probably worked at the same era. Well, I know you worked in the same era, but certainly where I worked, there was a criteria that to access feeding support services, you needed to be below the 10th percentile for weight. So there had to be an inherent component of growth faltering. And what parents would say to us is, so if I address that by making sure that they get the nutrition they need via a feeding tube or by modified food and fluids, and then they're not growth faltering, you're now telling me I can't access the very support that was what helped them get out of that category where they were growth faltering. And so that is a frustration that I felt those old-based, impairment-based diagnoses criteria really didn't help families and really didn't recognize how much work families would have to put in place to keep their child healthy, and that they needed to continue to receive that support after they got them past a certain threshold.
Even the screening that was happening in the community from pediatricians and referral sources largely depended on the child being under the 10th percentile and experiencing growth faltering before they could even be referred in. So it was very challenging for families. And then again, once they went above the 10th percentile and the growth wasn't an issue anymore, then services were not available, even though that wasn't the family's overall goal for their child to have a G-tube for the rest of their life. They were kind of locked out of accessing providers that could help the child continue to grow in their function and ability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, PFD came out, and then you kind of had like the years after. And I remember a conversation with you all where you were like, we have this, but the diagnostics of it are kind of a barrier. And what I appreciate about what you all have done is really identified a pathway to this is the barrier, and here might be a solution for that. So maybe talk to me a little bit about what you were seeing as barriers once we had PFD and we're seeing kind of the diagnostics or the tool usage and all of that stuff that led into your work right now.
Yeah, I think some of that evolved because of the different settings that we were in. So I transitioned into an academic setting and work in an outpatient facility now, where previously I had been part of a true multidisciplinary team where everybody is on site together. And the feeding clinic had the advantage of the pediatrician or the developmental pediatrician, the GI, the nutritionist, the SLP, like everybody in the same room at the same time, into a setting where we were getting referrals for children that were in the community that were most of them otherwise healthy. you know, going to school, doing things, but had very limited diet, and their feeding abilities were a concern for their family. So then trying to understand how to do a comprehensive assessment in an outpatient setting where one discipline is present, but we're trying to evaluate across those four subdomains. We could show that there was impaired oral intake, but to get that diagnosis, we also wanted to make sure that we were documenting the four subdomains that could potentially be impacted. So I reached out to Dr. Dodrell and to our colleague, Dr. Jean Marshall, who is the lead author on the reviews there, to say, how are you doing this? Like, what does your assessment look like in your facility? And then that's when we really began to see the variety of approaches to diagnosis, which led us to try to identify the tools that were available that were valid and reliable that would be appropriate for use across a PFD assessment.
And the two papers that I think we're talking about, the review papers from 2023 and 2025, both have Jean Marshall as the first author and us as co-authors. And one is really focused on feeding tools that assess with clinician-assessed feeding skills for PFD, and the other is a patient-reported outcome measures that either the child or the parent as their proxy would report. And just looking what's already out there, we all know, I think if you've worked in this area for a while, of lots of different tools that people are using themselves, but like, are there any that really have been assessed in terms of reliability, validity? Like, are they highly correlated with other important health measures? And then also, do they track change over time? Because we don't just want to capture an issue in a moment. We want to capture if the condition's getting better or worse. I think all of us who work in this area stress about the idea of someone not getting detected in time and not having timely attention to their issues or not being able to show improvement over time. And so those are the things that we're looking to see what's already out there and then what do we need to work on developing in the future.
That first paper in 2023 really focused in on patient-reported and by proxy parent-reported outcome measures that are in the literature that are capturing the way that we organized the review was looking at those. We mapped the tools that are available to the ICF model to show which ones are going to inform about activity, participation, trying to maybe retrofit tools that weren't developed specifically for PFD. A lot of them had come out ahead of time, but showing our broader clinical and research community how these tools fit into that model.
And you won't be surprised to know, and if you've read it, you'll see the results that most actually focus on the impairment phase versus the activity and participation. And a lot of that's just to do with time and money, that it's easier to collect things immediately in the moment than to track things over time. And it's often easier to get data from a chart review versus asking people questions and following them through. And it's not to mean that those other issues aren't worth pursuing, but it's what's currently available is very focused on the immediate and what it can be measured easily from a medical chart review or a quick assessment with the eye versus the type of questions that require interview and discussion with families and patients themselves. So it does certainly show that there are some tools available, but there's a lot more expansion that needs to happen in terms of measuring how PFD affects children's ability to participate in activities of daily living and also just how they can participate in social activities and what it means for their families. I know Feeding Matters did a fantastic survey at one point a while ago, just asking families, insured families, which I couldn't believe how much money this would cost, and over $100,000 in terms of co-pays, travel time, lost job opportunities. I mean, that's wild. But I know that you guys spend a huge amount of money and time to collect that information. But that's really something we should be looking at for all of our families to really show that this can have a huge impact on the child and the family.
Yeah, that's so true. And that's not even like published because that we just did that under our brand. We always, when we're trying to do stuff, we're like, do we put it in the literature? Do we put it out from a Feeding Matters standpoint? And that paper was about like, how can we really emphasize to public health leaders, to legislators, right, like the real devastating impact this is, even just financially for insured families, right? And I mean, it would be interesting to do it again and probably really even more sobering to do it again. But yeah, it's a true impact. There were just surprises, I think, even to me who had been in the population for a while, of some of the things that the families were sharing, because they shared like case logs of like they had to get new carpet or
right
jobs that they didn't take. So it really captured kind of all of those things. But to that point of really looking into areas that don't have a lot of research or work done, I think those two publications for you all then really identified where you might go next. And so maybe talk to me a little bit about what that looks like for you all and how you made that decision and what that looks like.
Look, there's definitely a lot of room for a lot of future research in this area, but one tool that we've started off adapting is an adult tool called the Functional Oral Intake Scale. So the Functional Oral Intake Scale, or FOIS scale, is one that Mike Currier and Giselle Carnaby developed for the adult world. We were looking to use it straight up, but there's definitely adaptations that needed to be made for the pediatric population, just reflecting the fact that children change over time anyway, and just some of the things that are a bit different. And so we worked with them and developed this 6-point scale. So one is nothing by mouth. Six is everything by mouth with no adaptions relative to your peers. And in between, there's levels that are some oral intake and some tube feeds, and then full oral intake, but with modified food or fluids or special feeding equipment or strategies, which is heavily grounded in the definition of PFD. We're requiring special food or fluid equipment and or strategies is considered kind of a core component of having PFD. So we wanted to be able to capture that. And so we adapted this tool. We did a lot of work looking at reliability. So could the same person score the same patient?
I was going to ask you to go into that a little bit more, the definition of it.
Yeah. So the reliability was both the same person intra-rater reliability and inter-rater reliability. We had a whole bunch of us rate, mixed them all up and had a bunch of us rate to see that we could score them the same. So a lot of speech pathologists, because we're often involved in scoring feeding skill-based, but we also asked doctors and nurses and dietitians to score as well, and parents of children who had pediatric feeding disorder. Not speaking very well today. We showed that it's a fairly easy tool to score. And so we did have high inter and intra rater reliability. We also wanted to look at whether it was valid in the sense that as your score changed on that, did it change in other meaningful ways? So we were able to show that as you were eating more of your total fluid requirements by mouth, your score went up. As you needed less compensations, your score went up, but also that it was highly correlated with things like a child's gestational age at birth. So the more premature infants took longer to move through the scales. The children with more significant lung disease took longer to move through the scales. And also length of stay. It was correlated with the children who took longer to move through the stages tended to stay in hospital longer. So it was reliable. But it also allowed us to track change over time so that you could see the same patient. So for me, I work mostly in the NICU. And so most of my patients start off at a 1 with nothing by mouth and then move through the different stages. And some of them go home eating like other children their age, but a lot of them go home still needing compensations like thickened liquids or special feeding equipment, and that's captured. And then we keep tracking them after they leave the NICU to see at what point do they get to a stage where they don't need those compensations. And that helps us to plan for the services these children need, but it also helps us to give guidance to parents about what to expect, but also to our colleagues about what to expect, and recognizing that a lot of our babies go home eating everything by mouth, but a lot of them go home needing special equipment and strategies and continued support needs. So anyhow, we are in the final processes of writing that up now. We've presented it at a few conferences, taken good feedback from people at those conferences, and are eager to get it out. It's actually being used at a fair few hospitals now in the meantime, because I think people can see it's fairly easy to score, but it does give a meaningful representation of is the child eating, are they a kid you could just drop off to daycare, or are they a kid you need to drop off with special feeding equipment and a list of instructions of what to do? So it's one tool. There's definitely room for others, but it's one fairly easy to score tool that we adapted from the adult world that we're looking to roll out as soon as possible.
And it does help to fill one of the gaps that we identified with those previous two reviews that we did, and that's the ability to track change over time. So much of what's currently available does not have that ability to show us what happens over time and to be able to show improvement with intervention, to be able to justify services, which was sorely missing from the tools that were currently available to us. So I think it does begin to address some of the needs that we identified with the with the reviews that we put out initially.
And the scoring tool allows you to go both ways. We certainly have children who regress at different stages. In any medically complex population, there'll be times where the child needs to go back to using more supports than they did before. So it does allow change to be tracked in a forward direction, as well as when there's regression due to illness or developmental challenges or other things that come up, or if a family no longer has access to the equipment or the strategies that they need. And so that's certainly something that we want to be able to capture. And again, recognizing that as children are moving further along, it's with a lot of support from their family that gets them there, that the same child, if they didn't have access to a supportive environment, would not be doing it as well as they could be with those supports in place.
And the other piece that I want to highlight that you mentioned is the ability for us to use this tool to have accurate and consistent communication across disciplines. So because PFD requires a multidisciplinary assessment and approach for the best outcomes, I think utilizing tools that create and give a shared language across a very complex condition like PFD did, the diagnostic code there and the definition, a tool like this also helps to improve communication as kids are going between different centers and different providers. Tools that provide common language that can show progress or regression, like the VoiceP is designed to do, then that also is going to improve outcomes in this population as well.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's so needed. All of it, tracking over time, I think being able to show progress, if you are trying to, I know a lot of, especially community providers have trouble sharing their goals and establishing that communication with the insurance providers as well. And so being able to have a meaningful measure to track that, that's can also be tied back into the literature is really important.
I just wanted to share, this conversation happened during the consensus group, and it's something that just does come up all the time. And I don't know if I'm getting too far into the weeds here,
it's so funny that you're headed there, because that's what I was going to share too, is like they kept asking for a tool from the feeding skill domain.
Right. And I think it's one of those things that you can get caught up in the technicalities of how many chews should a kid be doing in a certain amount of time, or at a general gestalt level. I think most people can tell if a child is doing what other children their age can do or not, or do you need to make modifications relative to other children. And there has been a little bit of backwards and forwards within our profession about whether we actually, in the PFD diagnosis definition, should have had age appropriate or developmentally appropriate. And we recognize that many children with developmental challenges are not going to ever get to a point where they're displaying age appropriate skills. But we also recognize that almost everything in your life is based on your date of birth. And that if you can't do things that other people who are born around the same time that you can do, you will need extra support, or you will potentially have difficulties that other children wouldn't. So if you don't have the chewing skills to eat bigger, harder pieces of food, and you don't have access to softer, smaller pieces of food, you are either not going to grow well or be at risk of choking. Whereas if given the food that you need, you will be able to eat more independently and eat to meet your nutritional needs more functionally. And so we did end up sticking with this definition of age, because most things in school are based on age. And if you can't do what others your age can do, it's just recognizing that you need more support. It's not, again, trying to stigmatize anybody. It's just trying to recognize that. And this tool also uses the words age appropriate, because we just want to capture, are you doing what other children would do? And I think, like I say, it's a very easy to use tool because it is quite broad, but it's saying, are you doing what other children your age would do, or do you need modifications to the strategies or the equipment or to the food itself? And I think because it is so basic, I think it kind of captures the fundamental aspects of this, that someone needs more support than other people do, or that they're thriving and that they don't need that additional support. That's where, like I say, there's other tools will be needed at different times to help, but this is kind of like a basic kind of first step.
Yeah, well, that's true. And it kind of transitions to that feeding development piece in general about how there just isn't the background to be able to define feeding development as its own domain. And so having the age appropriate aligned with development in childhood and milestones in early childhood, that can build something together with the field and also to better support and offer supports for patients and families.
Right.
So anything else that you both want to share about the tool? Did we say the name of it? You used your acronym, FOISP, yeah. Right?
It is.
Maybe share with everybody what it is so they can learn about it a little bit. And then when your publication gets published, we'll also share about it then too.
It's the Functional Oral Intake Scale Pediatric. So it's an adaptation of the original Functional Oral Intake Scale, so FOISP. Like I say, we worked with Mike Crary and Giselle Carnaby, who were the authors of the original FOISP, and they understand why we want to make the adaptions for the pediatric version. It has actually been available in textbooks since 2015. It's widely available. It's free, and you don't need to do specialized training. We did the paper because we wanted to show in a formal way that it is reliable and valid, and that it does track progress over time. At the moment, I'm aware that several hospitals are using it mostly for research purposes, where they're trying to track outcomes of groups like former premature babies or children with congenital heart disease, but certainly anyone's welcome to. If you can't find it by searching for it, we can make it available on the Feeding Matters website. Like I say, it's already been published in textbooks and we use it all the time in presentations. And like I say, the original paper with the adult population is going on 20 something years old now, but we can explain the difference between the pediatric adaptation and the adult. The adult goes to 7 points, but we stop at 6 for the children because there's never truly in young children a diet that you don't need to somehow modify. You wouldn't
need. Yeah, kind of that autonomous eating. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And just recognizing separate to oral skills is cognitive skills and motor skills and everything else that play into feeding. It's certainly there and available. And like I say, maybe the easiest way is for us to make it available on the Feeding Matters website, and people are certainly welcome to use it. And then hopefully in the coming months, we'll have the formal paper out, but we've certainly presented it at conferences recently and we can share those posters.
Thank you so much for sharing about the FOISP, because I think it's important to disseminate, especially like very helpful tools for the field. I think it happens, what we've shared with our consortium, who is kind of the inspiration behind this podcast, is how long research takes, that you're doing all of this and then for the public to actually get it, it's just forever. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully we can shorten that with whatever we can do to kind of support sharing some great work that's happening in that regard too.
Well, and as more people use it, hopefully they will also publish their results, right? So it's not something where we're trying to circumvent the research process. It takes the time it takes to guarantee that things are valid and reliable, and happy to do that. But as we share the tool and make it widely available, then hopefully those results can be repeated and published, and it just strengthens the evidence base for the tool.
Definitely. Changing gears a little bit, because I know I'm keeping track of our time here, but you both probably have great perspective on this. So I wanted to talk to you about it. And so, Memory, I'll start with you first. We at Feeding Matters are very interested in what does it look like to have qualified providers and what the challenges are to being able to achieve that. And we've done some like survey research around how challenging it is for especially the feeding skill domain to be able to feel comfortable either coming out of school or even in the 10 years that they are in early career, how to find their way in this specialty. And so I'd love your perspectives, either like what is happening now that is either a barrier or working really well, and then what you think about mm-hmm. the future of the field in that regard too.
So I transitioned into an academic appointment more than 10 years ago now. And I shared that when I finished my training, that dysphagia itself wasn't something that was really focused on. We had some seminars, and certainly now most programs have a dedicated dysphagia course. Something that we did here at the University of Alabama was to make a series of courses. So you have a developmental course, which is the pediatric focus on what we know about feeding development and pediatric feeding disorders and pediatric dysphagia. So they have a course about that. And then there's a separate adult-based course. In terms of the future of that, I think just speaking from speech pathology perspective, our field has grown in terms of scope of practice exponentially over the last 20 years. So it went from a field where you could go into practice, at least in the United States, with an undergraduate degree. And so the undergraduate curriculum was more disordered focused, I think. And then you would go out and start your career with your undergraduate degree. And then they transitioned to where you needed a master's degree. And they put some boundaries around a minimum number of hours to practice, like to have clinical training and to practice. Then you still came out entry level, you know, so you are a clinical fellow. You are a clinical fellow for 9 months post graduation, with built-in safety nets, with supervision and mentorship available there. Something like PFD is an area, and pediatric dysphagia is an area where you need more specialized training post graduation than what we've previously been exposed to. Adult dysphagia, much the same way. It was recognized as a specialized area that you needed additional training. What we lack currently are standardized pathways to get to that training. Something that I've seen that I'm really excited about to see is moving away from more one-off kind of continuing education for an hour on a specific topic with no follow-up. I think what made me feel confident in my practice and expanded the knowledge and skills that I needed to be a competent clinician in this area was direct mentorship. I was working in a setting where there were advanced clinicians that mentored me in that process. And so, but that was almost serendipitous because of where I'd worked. And I know a lot of people want that specialized training, but don't work in a large metropolitan area that has.
Yeah. The access to a mentor is almost like serendipity.
Right. So now I've seen groups forming and providing that mentorship capability, even if you're not in those larger areas. So advanced level clinicians that are working with different groups to provide 6-month, 9-month-long mentorship opportunities that have the didactic training and like the traditional continuing education piece, but that's followed up with one-to-one mentorship about the specific clients and children that the individual that is seeking the training are working with to get that feedback. This is what I did. Here's how it turned out. And then having the mentor walk them through the decision process and the whole algorithm of what the options were. So I think that's an improvement. On the academic side, I think our field has expanded now to the point where we can't just keep adding a coursework to it, right? Like we can't do one more class that's just specific to something like pediatric dysphagia. I think moving more towards a holistic approach to our field where we know that speech, language, hearing, voice, and swallowing are all related. And so instead of having individual courses on these topics, coming at it from more of an interdisciplinary IPE approach where we are client-focused, person-focused. So when the person comes in with these diagnoses, thinking through how that's going to impact speech, language, voice, swallowing, assessment and treatment throughout the lifespan. So I don't know how that looks in terms of reorganizing clinical training and academic training, but I think that's where we need to go. No longer do we see children, like as an example, that come in that just have speech sound difficulties with R, right? Most of the kids that come in here cross domains, cross different diagnostic categories, and training new clinicians, training the next generation of clinicians to think more holistically is where my focus is in an academic training setting.
And obviously a great foundation from your university time is important.
Yes.
But as a health professional, you're signing up to lifelong learning because new information becomes available each year, new tools become available each year, the healthcare system changes each year. I was somewhat lucky in that I trained in Australia and worked there for the first 13 years of my career before coming over here. In that, I mean, I've had great opportunities here, but in Australia, most of us were employed by our state-based government healthcare system. And so we had a process where if you were working in pediatric feeding, you were required to do ongoing training. And there was a formalized package and it involved both
core reading materials, but then also using telehealth to link in. And like Memory was describing, where you would speak with peers, problem solve issues. And that was easier to coordinate when we mostly all had the same employer and where there was an incentive for our employer to encourage that. I think here in the US, where most people are employed by separate private companies, I think it's the role of our associations, our professional associations, to advocate that we need to do ongoing professional development. It's fantastic when groups like Feeding Matters both run your own events and advertise other events that are available. But I do think peer-to-peer based mentoring programs need to happen. And at some level, when you work for different employers, I think it needs to be recognized, if I'm going to be honest, that somebody, there needs to be some kind of financial covering of people's cost for these things. But then I think at a certain level, more junior clinicians need to advocate and need the support of our association to advocate to their employers that they shouldn't be put in the position of managing very complex cases without having someone to mentor. And if you live somewhere where you don't have a big team on site and you need to access that virtually, then I do think that junior clinicians need the support of our association and more senior clinicians to say, that's very reasonable that you should have that. And even if there is some cost to your employer in facilitating you getting that ongoing training and mentoring, that needs to happen. And so I think there's a certain amount that people are willing to share out of kindness and compassion for and just genuine interest in patient outcomes. Yeah. But at a certain level, if someone's being asked to manage quite a complex caseload, then there is a professional development requirement from their employer to make sure that they're offering a safe and evidence-based practice. Mm-hmm. And so I think more than ever, we have fantastic tools available like telehealth. Mm-hmm. The fact that you can speak with somebody who's on the other side of the country or the other side of the world and problem solve issues. There are just the little things that we need to work through, like making sure that HIPAA requirements are being adhered to, and that people's own IP is being protected as well. There's things that we just need to work through, but it's not impossible, and like better than ever before. I think I mentioned I went on a sponsored travel experience in 2008 because back then there wasn't Zoom and everything else. And if you wanted to go and like meet the master, you had to kind of show up and ask if you could follow them around. Whereas now I think you can often FaceTime with people and learn a lot more readily. So those are things that I think are exciting. Also just to plug some of the fantastic things that were happening back in Australia where I came from, Professor Liz Ward and also Dr. Jean Marshall, who we were talking about before, and Dr. Maddie Ratz are doing fantastic work in telehealth, both in terms of patient assessment and treatment, but also in terms of peer mentorship, and also looking at simulation as a way to build and maintain skills in clinicians working in this area. They've got some really innovative work happening. And so Liz Ward, Maddie Ratz, and Jean Marshall are exciting names to look for in the literature. They're really looking at using technology to help support teaching and training and also to provide care to people who live a bit further away than where the service is based.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That rural metro area challenge that we see so many of our families experience, I know, is a huge challenge in Australia as well. We've had Dr. Marshall on, but it would be good for the next time to have all three of you on together to be able to share and talk, because a lot of what we talked about with her was in the work that like she's also overseeing and in some of her students' work as well. So we'll make sure we do that next too. But as we kind of close out here, I have two final questions for you both. So what's something that you have hope for in where the feeding field is going? Because I know it's taking a lot of momentum to build, and now we're starting to see some exponential payoff. But what's something that gives you hope for the future of the field?
I'm encouraged by the number of clinicians and researchers that are involved in PFD. So I mentioned how Pamela and I met. We were at a conference where there were senior researchers, but like two of them, and then she and I that were newer to the field. And so a total of four in a group of 500. And now I can count 20 easily off the top of my head that are working and that are leading voices in this area. And what is, besides just having more people involved, each one is approaching it from a different standpoint. And so bringing new information and advancing the field across all of the different areas of need, not just one singular focus on like sucking and bottle feeding or breastfeeding. Like now there is momentum and change happening across all the different areas related to assessment and to treatment. And so with those voices and with that emphasis on evidence-based efficacious care, what I'm excited about is the move away from some of the interventions that used to be standard of care, just standard practice, that we would do these things without them having a big benefit for the family. And so the involvement of the family in the discussion, shared decision-making, using the ICF framework to focus on function instead of you have to do these specific skills in this order, but what does it mean to be functional within this family unit? What are the foods that are important to this family? And let's work towards that with the family as true care partners with that shared decision-making framework is exciting to me. I love to see it.
And similar to that, I mean, to me, it's telehealth. I think the idea that you can see someone in their own home, in their own context, is really exciting. I also have loved how it's being used more recently in the transition to home from like being in a major hospital setting to being at home. That it used to be that when they, and for me, certainly working in a NICU setting or when I was at a children's hospital and we were working in the acute care team, when they left our hospital, they left our team and they went to an outpatient provider who they were meeting for the first time and who would have a different philosophy sometimes to how we approach things. Whereas now we're doing these transition to home programs where we're checking in with them, the same people they knew from inpatient. We're seeing them at home, helping them to problem solve the things that can so easily go wrong, but also really seeing if what we think would be helpful is actually helpful for them. And we have changed a lot of our discharge training and planning based on the fact that we have seen in reality it's not working or there's something that we need to tweak. And we wouldn't have known that if we hadn't checked in with the families in their own home in the weeks after they went home. And the goal is obviously to keep them at home and hopefully have them not readmit and to keep going along their journey towards wellness. And so I think I've learned a huge amount from seeing families in their home, hearing from the families what's working or not. And like I say, it absolutely has changed our inpatient practice. And I feel like even for those children who do need to go on to being tied in with a long-term kind of care center, whether that's a rehab center or another center, it's a bridge between leaving the hospital setting and moving over to that new service with people that they already know. And I think, like I say, we hope it's good for the families, but it's really also insightful for us too about whether or not what we're suggesting really is working for them.
And just underscore how important it is to see people in their natural environment.
That's how
I started in this field, and it informed everything I have done my whole career was because I started in somebody's home. They had been given discharge instructions 20 plus years ago. They came home. These were all medically complex kids that we were seeing, and being in their home and seeing what their day-to-day looked like really just, it changes.
It makes a huge difference. Totally. Right. And you all set me up so beautifully for our final question. What we ask everybody on the podcast is, what are the biggest challenges that you're seeing in making PFD and ARFID research more inclusive of family perspectives and that lived experience? And your answers from the previous question were about treatment and how do you incorporate using that shared framework and that co-learning that's happening. But what do you think about in terms of what needs to maybe be pushed in the research to make sure that lived experience is acknowledged and honored in that space too?
I do think a lot of research is done from chart review, and a chart review is only as good as what was put in the chart in the first place. And if you never ask the family what impact this was or what problems they anticipate with this, it's never going to appear in the chart review. And so at some level, we need better questionnaires that capture how this is likely to impact on the family so that the information is there. But also part of this is just spending the time to ask the family rather than just talking to them, talking with them about how they anticipate this will affect their quality of life, and then checking back with them to see whether or not, with our good intentions, whether or not this worked out or not. But some of it is spending the time in the first place. And simple tools sometimes help to get the data more than there's an importance to qualitative studies where you do full interviews, but there's also an importance for even just a basic checklist of have you asked the family if they can anticipate any issues. Yeah. And so I think we need to start somewhere, but we need to ask the families questions rather than just telling them information.
I think incorporating parent-reported patient-reported outcome measures into the chart, into the outcomes that we report on is a easy first step that would include families more, right. That would make their perspectives available when clinicians are doing chart reviews. Research is expensive and insurance is expensive. And, you know, all of this comes down to a bottom line of cost. And so incorporating more perspectives into the care planning comes with a financial cost, but then it also informs and hopefully will make the outcomes better, right? If we're working and including families as true members of the care team with their perspectives included, with that shared decision-making framework, then hopefully we move towards functional, desirable outcomes that much faster.
In the two review papers, a tool was used called COSMIN, which is like a more modern tool that's been developed that helps guide you through looking at the questionnaire. But one of the parts it asks about is, did the tool incorporate any consumers in the development of the tool? And it's interesting because I hope it's going to prompt more people, because if the tool we use to rate tools asks you, did you involve a consumer in the development of the tool? Hopefully it will prompt more people to involve a consumer in the development of the tool. So that then the questions aren't all just things that a health provider is trying to check off before they send you out the door. It's actually something that a parent would say, hold on, I would want someone to have asked me this before I went out the door. So that's certainly something that we all need to think about more going forward in developing tools of any type.
And played out in the review that we did, utilizing the COSMIN thing, we were able to show that the newer tools, more of them included a family perspective. More of them included parents and caregivers of children with the difficulties that it was screening for, talking about in the development of that tool. The family was part of the discussion there. So it makes it a stronger tool as we're rating it with something like COSMIN.
Yeah. And that's exactly what the consortium is here for, to engage and support this research from the lived experience side, to be able to engage with academics and researchers that are interested in the literature in that regard. And so I think anyone that's out there that's on the consortium and listening to both of you share this is going to be so excited to hear that, like, even the direction of research is headed in that way too, in a way that, like, incentivizes making sure there's, like, client and family engagement in the research as well. Well, Dr. Dodrell, Dr. Gosa, thank you so much for joining me and for sharing this. I could literally talk to you guys so long about this. I'm sorry that I went over our time, but it's so interesting. And we'll have you back with Dr. Marshall. And we'll also make sure we link out the two articles of the review and then share the other one when it does come out. But it was just such a pleasure being with you. And thank you so much for all you're doing for the field.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
When families face food disruption or uncertainty, every meal can feel even more overwhelming, especially with a child who has feeding differences. That's why Feeding Matters created a food access resources page on their It's Not Picky Eating website to help families find state and national resources, as well as guidance and support through Feeding Matters regional community councils. You'll also find a guide to help food banks and community partners better support families of children with feeding disorders and differences, as well as a guide for therapy offices to create community food tables. Visit itsnotpickyeating.org and click the link Food Access Resources.